Today, we'll be covering how to invest in real estate debt funds with private funds with our host and guest, RD Advisors. Before we get started, we do have a quick disclaimer. Entrust does not provide investment advice, tax advice, or legal advice. We are not CPAs, attorneys, or financial advisors. We do not recommend or endorse any investments, products, or services. The information in this presentation is for educational purposes only. We do, however, recommend that you seek investment, tax, and legal advice before entering into any investments. The agenda for today's webinar, first we'll start off talking a little bit about the Entrust Group. Then we'll cover what private real estate debt funds are, how to evaluate real estate debt funds, risk management tools available to investors, the pros and cons of real estate debt investing, and at the end, we will have time for Q&A. A little bit about myself. My name is Tony Uncle. I am the Business Development Manager for the Northeast for the Entrust Group. Been in the retirement industry for a little over 4 years, and we pride ourselves on educating investors and professionals on tax-preferred retirement accounts. First, I want to share a little background on our company for those of you who are not already familiar with the Entrust Group. We are a self-directed IRA record keepers and custodians who specialize in holding alternative assets inside their retirement accounts for our clients. We have been doing this for nearly 40 years. We have empowered around 45,000 investors with $4 billion in assets under administration. And something that really sets Entrust apart from the rest of the self-directed custodians is we do offer you one single point of contact based on the region that you live in. Entrust is self-directed IRA administrators. Our staff is extremely knowledgeable, and most of us do hold the CISP designation, Certified IRA Service Provider. We have nationwide offices throughout the country. We hold in-person events and virtual webinars. We offer national continuing education program for other credentials, and we do hold our biannual IRA Academy. What is a self-directed IRA? Self-directed IRA is a retirement account in which the individual investor is in charge of making all investment decisions. A self-directed IRA provides the investor with greater opportunity for asset diversification outside of traditional stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. For example, some assets that can be held are real estate, private tax liens, and notes. All securities and investments are held in an account administered by a custodian or a trustee. Now we'd like to turn it over to Sean at RD Advisors, who will walk you through private real estate debt funds. Thank you.
Hey, guys. Good to meet everybody on the line today. So today's webinar is kind of an educational webinar for everyone. I will go a bit over my background, my personal background, kind of what gives me the credibility to kind of give you an overview of private real estate debt funds. And then two, talk really about the industry. And the goal here is by the end of this presentation, you will not necessarily be an expert on real estate debt funds, but you'll have the tools to ask the right questions and the tools to understand as you're going through a prospectus, what to look for, what to understand, and how to differentiate one private debt fund versus another. So let's kick it off. Let's go to the first slide. We'll talk about my background. And again, the all important disclaimers. Everyone knows. So my background, so I'm the managing partner of RD Advisors. We are a real estate private debt firm, or also referred to as a private credit firm. I've been in real estate for about 20 years now. It's something that I'm extremely passionate about. I started out, my mother sold foreclosures for Fannie Mae in the 90s as a real estate agent. My father was a carpenter and then an architect. And I bought my first investment property about 3 months after graduating from college. And I've been at it ever since. I went to Columbia Business School to kind of further my education within the real estate sector and the business and finance. After that, I moved for London for about a decade, where I had various roles, including Lehman Brothers, where we financed several billion dollars worth of properties across Europe and the US. And then further on there, after doing a number of stints in debt restructuring in that time, so just think about the 2008 to 2000, kind of I would call it 12 period, when I guess this is when debt funds really came in vogue on an institutional scale. They'd kind of been in existence for a long time, but the banks at that point really pulled out of the industry and opened it up for what we will call private credit, right? At that time, I ran the London office for multi-billion dollar real estate private equity fund, and then came back to the US and did a number of roles within the multifamily sector and essentially the single small balance single family sector. And then 5 years ago, we set up RD Advisors in partnership with the family office. They had been an investor with me personally in the Boston area and asked me to kind of help them strategize on where we could find outsized returns and really risk-weighted returns. And I think this is a big thing that we talk about and think about when we're doing our investments. So, you know, an IRR, a lot of people look at an IRR and say, well, what is the IRR of this investment versus the IRR of another investment? I think as we get more sophisticated and we look at this, we start looking at the volatility of investments. We start looking at the risk weighting. So what is the likelihood that we would lose on an investment versus holding it, right? So the market may go up 30% one day or kind of over a period of time, but also what is the risk that it may go down? How far can that fall? And that's what we looked at in the private debt credit sector. And what we liked about it on the real estate sector is we thought it was a relatively stable sector, and where if we put in, you know, kind of the commensurate work, we would be rewarded with, you know, steady dividends. And I think that's part of the thing that we think about and where we are in the sector is we focus on the smaller balance loans because we find that there's an outsized return for really what we call creating a factory to originate and close loans. That is not available when you're looking at, you know, a multi-billion dollar fund where it's much more competitive. And we can use our advantage in terms of our expertise and our I would say we all have institutional backgrounds, focusing on a non-transparent market that is, it's much less competitive. But we'll carry on. People can ask me about my background later and more specifics about what I've done. But let's go on to the next slide and kick it off about real estate credit. So what is a debt fund? And you're going to hear it called a number of different names. It could be a real estate private credit fund. It could be a private equity fund focused on real estate debt. You might also see it as a private REIT. That's a different structure from a tax perspective. Essentially, they are all pools of capital, whether they are opened or closed, to invest in loans that are collateralized by real estate. So there could be a number of things. So, and just differentiating here, there you either originate the loans. And so what does that mean? And so a debt fund goes out and they have a team that makes the loans. So they write the loans, they go out, they find the borrowers. Or there's groups that effectively buy the loans. So somebody else is making the loans and they are not originating the loans, they actually purchase the loans themselves. They purchase the loans and hold them. You could also purchase performing loans and non-performing loans. So performing loans, you know, very clearly are somebody's paying on time. Non-performing loans could be somebody's missed one payment to something where the entire loan is in default. There's very little value in the property and somebody's buying it, hopefully at a steep discount. And you could buy those as one-offs or you could buy pools of those. And, you know, then we could talk about size and those factors. But I think it's worthwhile for us to go on now to the next slide. So what are we in? And then let's, I guess, think about the debt fund. We also have to think about who is the client of the debt fund. So the borrower themselves and what are they using it for? And you can think about the different size, right? So debt funds can vary from, you know, small size, friends and family, pool of capital that's being put together that may be $3 or $4 million or less, to something that could be, you know, Blackstone's latest, you know, fund, which may be up to 10 billion. And so the scale of the fund kind of determines the scale of the borrowers. So what are some of the uses, right? So One of them is acquiring the property. So somebody's going to go to a debt fund and use their funds to acquire a property. It could be construction and renovation, a refinance. It could be ground up developments. It could be bridge capital. Now you hear this, some funds might be called a bridge fund, a bridge debt fund. And what that is it's clearly people are borrowing the money for a very short period of time with an expected short-term refinance. And what are the scales? You know, we're talking about anywhere from, you know, $100,000 fix and flip in the suburbs to something that's much larger, which could be $1 billion, you know, ground up construction project. And then one of the things we have to think about is why would somebody go to a real estate debt fund versus going to a bank? And, you know, I'm constantly asked by banks and by other people in the industry that are not as familiar with the debt funds. They're very familiar with real estate financing, and they ask, why would anybody go to anywhere other than a bank? Don't the banks finance anything? And the banks are at, you know, 3% rates to, you know, 5% rates. And again, that's a moving target. But one of the things thinking about is that banks are heavily regulated, and this increased substantially after the financial crisis. And that's greatly restricted their ability to enter into new loans, and especially what type of loans. Well, one is speed. So private funds typically move very quickly. So they're staffed up with real estate experts that have, in many cases, many years of real estate financing experience. A lot of times they cut out a lot of the, we'd call it the noise that the banks need to do from a regulatory perspective, and really focus on the asset. And I would say in many cases, from a very broad perspective, banks often focus on the borrowers, and real estate credit funds or debt funds focus on the asset. And what do I mean by that? It's not that we as a debt fund and credit fund, we definitely look at the borrower. The banks would look first to the borrower. Is this a borrower I want to deal with? If so, then I'm willing to look at this project. The credit fund first looks at, is this a project I want to deal with? And if so, I'll look at the borrower. And why is the difference? And I think it has to do with what happens when to go into default. So if a loan goes into a default, banks are heavily penalized. On a fund, if a loan goes into a default, many funds, and I'm not saying this, just say, okay, well, that's fine. We underwrote it with the idea that if it went into default, then we may potentially own it, but we own it at a discounted basis. And we'll talk about that later. What do we mean by basis and loan to value? But again, here we're just talking about the basic concepts to get us started. So let's scroll down to the next slide now. And I think just pause here, and I think we can look here at just this slide is meant to go, here's what we're talking about coming out of the financial crisis, the growth of real estate debt funds. And that's really a function of the opportunity set, right? So as banks have pulled away from real estate construction financing and have gotten simply a lot more bureaucratic, and it's harder for them to close on new loans and take on new clients and that marginal clients, it's really opened up the sector for debt funds. And you just see that. And I see it continuing to expand. I think that the role for real estate private credit is growing and growing. And also it's an appetite for the investor. So from the investor's standpoint, there's a huge need for credit. And if you look out there in the sector and you say, and this is one of the things we looked at when we were setting up our fund, is how do we generate yield for our investors? And when you go out there and you look at the public markets, there's very few ways to consistently generate yield. Private credit has been a huge way for investors to invest in and generate private credit. And I think it's one of the things, I think it's great that initially a lot of these were only opened up to institutions or qualified investors or ultra high net worth investors. I think what we're seeing now is a number of these credit funds opportunities are opening up to smaller investors, to mom and pop investors. And I think that's been a big thing for the industry. And I think it's a big thing for the investors as well, being able to put their money somewhere where they can actually generate a yield, as opposed to just, you know, market-based capital returns. So we'll switch to the slide now, and I'm happy to chat more about the growth of the industry later. So how do funds differentiate themselves? So we can think about how we differentiate ourselves to our clients, which are end borrowers, but really how do we differentiate ourselves to our investors? And so one thing I would think about, and I constantly emphasize this, is not all debt funds are the same. Somebody says, I have this debt fund and they are targeting a 15% return. And I go, well, what do they do? What kind of debt do they do? What are their loans? What is their loan size? And what is their position in the capital stack? And this is, you know, we'll talk more about this, but it's incredibly important because that determines the level of risk. Are you being paid adequately for the risk you're taking? A 15% return in a high risk position, in my view, is not enough compensation for taking on that additional risk, right? So one of the things is if you ask, is the senior debt fund, is it a senior secured debt fund, or is it a debt fund that's focused on mezzanine positions? And mezzanine is the position where there's the senior debt, if there's any losses, the senior debt is the last person to take a loss. The mezzanine is in between the senior debt and the equity. The equity is the first person to take a loss. We'll talk about the position in the capital stack, but that's something very important to pay attention to when you're evaluating any debt fund. And then we go to the fund size and the loan size. So there's two things there. So the fund size somewhat determines the loan size. And that's not always true because you can be a very large fund and own a whole bunch of small loans, but you probably didn't originate them yourself. You've probably purchased those loans off of another fund at a premium. So the larger the fund, it's more likely that they're in a more competitive space. So the yield and the yield on their loans are higher, right? So somebody who's borrowing $1 billion is probably not going to pay a 10% rate for a low risk loan. Somebody borrowing $100,000 may pay 10% for what is a loan risk rate for the convenience, right? It's just not that much money per month or per year to pay 10% on $100,000. But on $1 billion, it's a very competitive sector. So the returns may be slightly different. And then who you're dealing with as a client, right? So if it's a $1 billion loan and a multi-billion-dollar fund, you're probably dealing with institutional clients, which has its pluses and its minuses. If something goes wrong, it's less, you've got a very sophisticated counterparty on the other side. That also could mean that they're very well lawyered up and it's very hard to foreclose and get your collateral back. On the smaller side, people might walk away, but it's also you're spending, you know, you've got a $100,000 loan and that your borrower might not be as sophisticated. We're somewhere in between. We're trying to find the most sophisticated borrowers on probably about an average of $1 million loan size. So then the next portion is the loan to value ratio. And again, this is critical. And that's critical for both when you're talking about a mezzanine and your senior secured. So if somebody says, I offer loans up to, you know, 70% loan to value, that means that the borrower is typically putting in 30% of the equity. That doesn't always mean they're putting in 30% of the cash, because you can imagine if it's a refinance and they have a property that they bought, you know, years ago and it's gone up in value, you're lending, you know, 70% of today's value, but typically means that today you have about a 30% cushion between where the values are today and where the loan break point is. And, you know, so where do, you know, what are typical values? I think senior debt funds would be somewhere capped out at somewhere between 70 and 80% loan to values. Mezzanine funds would go much higher there, often into 90% loan to value on top of senior. And they'll have what they cut their cutoffs. So they'll go from a 70%, i.e. meaning the senior below is at 70, and they're going from 70 to 90. But it's interesting. That's one of the things to pay attention to if you're looking at a mezzanine fund, right? And it's very close to equity, right? So you would expect more equity-like returns. Loan documents, very important. Again, it's not necessarily how the funds differentiate themselves to the investors. We don't spend tons of time going through loan documents that we have the borrowers, but it's how we differentiate ourselves to the end borrower. How extensive is our documentation process? How many bits of information are we collecting from the borrower? That's a huge thing on our side. I think we consider ourselves probably a little bit document heavy, but that also means that we're doing a lot more evaluation per loan, but it also means that we're not doing tons of smaller loans that may have a higher yield, right? We're somewhere in the middle. It has to be worthwhile. Diversification. So how many loans are in the pool? How many, and then how is it diversified across the US, across the world, across various borrowers? So you may have a debt fund that is, you know, $100 million, but it's got five different borrowers and 10 different loans, right? So, you know, if one borrower goes down completely and goes bankrupt, you've got 20% of your portfolio at risk. And that's something that's very important to pay attention to, especially if it's a higher risk fund, right? So how likely is any one borrower going to be to impact the fund? And then the second is leverage. And this is where we're talking about not necessarily leverage on the individual property at the end, but leverage on the loan. So just as an individual can buy a house and borrow from the bank, a private credit fund can essentially, their asset is the loan, and they can borrow against the loan. And so there's anywhere from unlevered strategies where there's no leverage on the fund whatsoever to highly levered strategies where maybe, you know, the fund believes that the loans are highly secure and unlikely to go into default, and they'll borrow up to 90% of the value of the loan, right? So the loan is at 70% LTV and they borrowed up 90% of that 70% LTV. We're somewhere in between. We're anywhere from probably today at 40% leverage up to in the future, maybe 65% leverage. But again, depends on the loans that we have on our books. And then the type of loans, again, performing or non-performing. If it's performing loans, so all the loans are paying and you expect them to continue paying, that's one level of return. Non-performing loans, you're effectively buying the loan, either expecting the loan to return to performing or that there would be some sort of foreclosure. They're a lot harder to deal with. The returns are less yield-like and more equity-like, right? So the loan is non-performing, i.e. is not currently paying interest, but however, at some point in time, you expect to have an exit. So therefore, you will receive one lump sum payment on the loan. And that I would expect a much higher return in exchange for non-performing loans. And then second is, what is the underlying collateral? So are we talking about development or stabilized assets? So are these ground up construction loans? So we're building a building, or are these things where you're lending on an existing building full of tenants already? And those have different risk profiles. So those are questions to ask. And these are kind of, this is just a framework to look at a fund. And then one thing is the debt duration. And, you know, people talk about duration risk, and I think this is very similar to any bond fund. So I'm sure that there's some presentations on how to evaluate bond funds. So is this short-term credit or long-term credit? And this is what we want to think about in terms of, so let's say today you give a loan at 5%. Well, if you give a loan at 5%, if it's a 1 year, you're being paid for 5% for that 1 year. The problem is if you give a loan, and this is where you have issues with the long-term rates, if you give a loan for 3%, and it's, you say, this is almost risk-free, we're going to give it at 3%, and you give it for 10 years. What happens if your cost of capital rises to 3.5% by the end of the year? So it's very important, that debt duration. We focus on a 1 year duration. So we give a loan today, and every year our loans are reset. And that's, so it's a short term 12 month duration. Other funds on the debt side may have up to 5 year durations. Most debt funds, unlike banks or securities, don't have longer term durations, although there are many debt funds out there that buy longer term duration debt. And what happens is on long term duration, just as it does with long term government treasuries, it's highly volatile. If the market value of that debt changes dramatically day to day based on the short term interest rates and the expected interest rates. So anyways, it's another thing to think about, whether how long the duration of the debt is. And if it's short term duration, one of the things to think about is there has to be a heavy investment team, because if it's a 1 year duration, that means that every month you're putting money out and it's coming back. It's constantly recycled. And I personally, I think that's a good thing. But let's go on to the next slide, and we can talk about some of these things in more depth. So here's where we're talking about the capital structure. And again, we want to talk about senior debt. And that's where we focus our time. And we'll go, you know, the most secure in the capital stack is senior debt. That's a senior secured mortgage. There really isn't much in terms of liens that are more, you are the first person to get paid in terms of a default or foreclosure. Outside of, and I think I would make some exceptions for people to understand this, that, you know, kind of taxes and municipal liens. So if somebody didn't pay their water bill, or they haven't paid their property tax, They are senior to the senior debt. But outside of that, the senior debt is senior to almost every other creditor out there. And that means that any other person out there, including mezzanine debt, would, in the case of foreclosure, be foreclosed on. And they would lose 100% of their capital. And the same thing with the preferred equity and the common equity. Now, the mezzanine debt, knowing that, typically requires a higher return in order to take that second place position. One of the other things out there is the mezzanine debt, if you think about it, and senior debt and lenders, what we tend to think about is not the upside scenario, right? So this is one of the things, think about debt versus equity, is your upside is typically known. You are paid, you make a loan at a 10% interest rate, the most you are ever paid in it, as the loan goes to plan, is that 10%. There could be some variability around that with, if you have fees, you have fees for renewing the debt, you have, the debt may increase in value, but you are a fixed income instrument, right? So that means that the income is fixed and set in advance. Unlike an equity where you can have, in some sense, infinite upside, right? So you have infinite possibilities. You can make anywhere from zero, losing 100% of the money, to it could double or triple. You typically don't have that with senior debt. So a mezzanine debt, you're somewhere between a senior debt and the equity, and the same with preferred equity, is you're being paid more to take on a little bit of risk. The mezzanine debt will typically have clauses in it that says, hey, if there's a default, I don't want the senior debt to default on me. I have a couple different options. So I can continue paying the senior debt on that behalf if they've worked that out into the agreement. Or if I'm a big enough fund and I'm diversified enough, I'll just buy the senior debt. I have the right that I've worked out. So there is something in there between the mezzanine debt and the senior debt, typically called an intercreditor. It's an agreement between what happens when the debt goes into default. Again, we're always thinking about these things when we're making a loan, as if from the debt side, as what happens in the if scenario, right? So, and I think very few loans go into default, you know, maybe, you know, probably under 10% go into actual default, and then maybe 3% or less ever go into foreclosure. But we always plan at the very beginning, what happens when something does go into default? So we spend a long time speaking about what if scenarios in the downside. But that's why you invest in senior debt, right? Because it's less volatile. When the market makes significant moves like today or kind of like this past month, it's very comforting to know that you're in the most senior position. And so let's go on further and talk about the next slide. So the fund and the loan size, I think we covered this a little bit before, but again, you're anywhere from single family homes, you know, are you doing fix and flip investing, or are you lending on skyscrapers in New York City, right? Which might be $1 billion ground up. And one of the things when you're thinking about the size of the loan is also the duration. You're typically not making $1 billion loan for a very short period of time, right? If it's a construction loan, it takes 5 years to build the building. And when you think about that duration risk and the size of the loan and kind of the correlating size of the investment and the time that it takes to build it, you need to start thinking about, well, if I make a loan today, by the time it gets paid off, so if that's 12 months from now, how likely is the market to move, right? If the market moves 5%, kind of who cares, right? Really doesn't change much for me. It changes a lot for the borrower, but I'm in a pretty secure position. If you're in a very large loan in a very large position, especially on the construction side, and you make a loan one day and 5 years later you get your money back, well, where we are today and where we are in 5 years or even 3 years could be in a vastly different market, right? So the interest rates could change, right? So you can make a mistake in pricing your interest rate too low. We're also in a position where who knows where the markets are and what the liquidity is for the underlying property, right? And by liquidity is how easy is it to sell or refinance. So anyways, that's what I'll put here. And again, we could go over this, and I'm passionate about it, so we could talk about this for days. But let's go on to the next slide. Again, loan to value ratio. So this is kind of where you are in the capital structure. And kind of here we've inverted the structure just kind of to show who's on top in some sense, right? So the senior structure, and this is where we're talking about the value, right? So if you have a loan to value and really basic stuff, and your loan to value is 65, right? So, you know, it's $100 million value or $1 million value, and it's 65%. The equity typically is 35%. And we're doing this without a mezzanine in here, but you would just imagine the mezzanine being another piece within that equity structure. If the value falls 10%, the equity has lost about, I would say, 40% of their value. The senior debt has not lost anything. We have not been touched. It does not change the value of the senior debt. We still have a significant cushion of value in front of us. And that's very important, right? Understanding. Now, if we had been at 95%, well, the equity would have been wiped out and we'd now be at 100%. So that loan to value is a very critical number when you're looking at any sort of debt instrument. And that's what gives you your comfort and kind of your ability to sleep at night, as we'd say, right? And, you know, my job from an investor and a fiduciary of capital's perspective is to make sure that all my investors can kind of sleep well at night knowing, all right, we're in a, you know, senior secured position, we're earning a decent yield. And as the market volatility moves, you know, I am not as affected, right? And we laugh about this. My partner is invested across asset classes. And, you know, he says, hey, you know, I lose sleep every time the market has that volatility. Makes me comforted knowing I've got, you know, funds allocated to this where it's more of a stable product. And I think that's the way we think about ourselves, is we're one tool within the toolkit that gives you some capital that's a little bit more stable. Let's go into the next slide and chat. So loan documents, and this is very granular, and this is one of these things that it's not extreme, it's extremely important, but it one of those things that you're looking at from an investor, you really just want to understand how sophisticated this is. You know, if you're looking at a $1 billion fund, I don't think you need to question these things. I think if you're looking at effectively investing in real estate credit with either a couple of friends and family or in a smaller fund, you really need to ask what type of work and what type of documentation they're doing. And I've seen this a number of times in my, you know, I've had friends or people in the industry said, hey, guess what? I've made some loans. I'm a real estate lender. I said, it's great. Good. And they're saying, we're getting paid 12% on it. And I said, oh, okay, great. Well, you know, what kind of documentation do you get? Oh, what documentation? Well, did you get a mortgage? Oh, I don't know if I got a mortgage. I just signed some documents. I don't know if I lent out the money. Well, do you have a mortgage or don't you have a mortgage? I mean, that is the biggest question. Whether you're in a first position or a second position, a mortgage is what effectively attaches the loan to the property. If you don't have a mortgage, it's really not a real estate loan. You're lending against an LLC. It's a loan to an LLC or a company that owns the real estate. And so you really need to go through and think about how well documented these loans are. And I think that's something really to think about if you're doing these loans on a personal basis. And I know a lot of people have done self-directed RIAs to go into, you know, participants in loans along with friends, either to do flips or these things. But really, these things matter, and they never matter. And everybody says these things, well, I don't know, I trust the guy and it's fine. It doesn't matter till your capital is on the line. And if you don't have some of these things, you could lose all of your funds. So it's very important to make sure you have a mortgage, make sure you have a promissory note, a loan agreement. And also think about on these things, a corporate or personal guarantee. So does the person who's borrowing the money, have they personally guaranteed it, right? Have they given a corporate guarantee? If not, what is your recourse if you lose money on the property to go after that individual, right? Are you covered? And then title. Was a proper title done? So you could put in a mortgage, but if you didn't do a title search and you don't have proper title insurance, you could find that your mortgage, which you thought was in first position, is actually in second, third, or worse, or wasn't properly recorded. So, you know, all of those things, I think, really kind of emphasize why I think that you should, you know, be really professional about it. Make sure that the team you're investing with knows what they're doing and really is using proper legal advice in doing these things, because I've seen a number of situations where this has gone horribly wrong. But let's move on from there. Diversification and really what do you want here is to think about it, right? So there's, if you're highly diversified as a fund, it means that you've invested across lots of different sectors, and it could be geography, it could be real estate type, right? You could be diversified across the US, but you could be very specific on your asset class, right? It's only hotels. Or you could be highly diversified in a single market where you have lots of small borrowers in a single market and lots of asset classes, right? Or you could be highly concentrated. And or it could be you only have three loans in your fund, right? Which isn't very diversified at all. How do we think about this? And personally, I think there's diversification is great from one hand. The downside of diversification is the person making a loan who's an expert in making retail loans in Atlanta is probably not the same person that is the expert at making residential loans in California. So if you have a retail loan in Atlanta and residential, you need to make sure that that person or that fund is large enough to have people that are experts in both. The other side of it is thinking about how they get their loans, right? So if you are expert or a niche, and what I'd like to say is a sharpshooter, and we think of ourselves as sharpshooters in the Boston market, right? We know our market really well. We typically focus on residential loans in that market, and we let our borrowers do the diversification. So we have our investors do the diversification. So they would invest with somebody in Boston who's an expert in Boston, and they would invest with somebody in Dallas who's an expert in Dallas. But they're not investing with a Dallas guy to do Boston, nor are they investing with the Boston guys to do Dallas, right? We all stay in our lane, and I think that's very important. And that's one of the things I spend a lot of time with institutional investors with, is institutional investors, when they sit down and they think about these things, so you've got the pension funds, one of the things they want the funds that they invest in to do is less diversification and more what they would say, stay in your lane. So if you're going to do real estate loans in the Boston market, and that's what you've told me you're going to do, and you told me you're doing senior secured, I'm going to focus my allocation on you based on what you say you're going to do. And so if the market changes, that's fine, because I've already balanced and I've diversified into a couple different markets or a couple different strategies. But if you change your strategy, it messes up my allocation. And so that's very important for us. What I do is kind of think about it from a fiduciary standpoint and think about it from an institutional standpoint. I stay in my lane. I do what I say I'm going to do. I think that's very important to look in terms of the diversification, and that this is slightly off topic, but has the fund that you're looking at stayed within what they said they were going to do? So if you look at their fund and they've done a whole bunch of things that are outside of what their original business plan was, it's a little bit worrying, because that's where funds tend to make mistakes, is they go into a market that they don't know very well or an asset type they don't very well. They get attracted by yields. They say, oh, I can earn, you know, my investors slightly more if I do this investment. What happens is they don't know it as well. And so I think that's very important that people pick a niche and stick with it. And if their niche is diversification, right? So we are going to take a senior secured, we're going to buy loans across the US, and we're going to be highly diversified, but we're a multi-billion dollar fund. I think that's one thing. I think their returns are going to reflect that. They're going to be slightly lower because they're effectively buying loans as opposed to originating it. And that's a big thing, is you get paid a higher yield to originate the loans, like be the expert on the ground. And I also think that you need to think about, from the borrower's perspective, looking at the person you're investing with, do they differentiate themselves? So if they're all over the US, how do they market to their borrowers? How do they find the borrowers? And I always find that if somebody calls me up from outside of my market looking for a loan in Dallas, and I'm not in Dallas, it probably means they've spoken to everybody in Dallas already, and everybody in Dallas has said no. So they're looking outside their market for somebody who might take a chance in that market. Well, that's probably not a good place to be in. If I'm in Boston, I find that people come to me because they know and they trust me, not necessarily because I have the best rates, right? So I may be earning more on my loan than somebody from Dallas is, but they come to me first because they trust me and they've worked with me in the past. That's one of the things to think about on kind of weighing diversification versus somebody who's a local sharpshooter. So let's go on to the next slide. We've covered that well. Leverage. So this again is leverage on the fund, on the individual asset. And that could be structured in a number of different ways. And again, we're getting very granular here on it, but I think it's worthwhile to think about it. So does somebody have, if you have leverage on an individual asset, right? So if something goes wrong on that property, there's no recourse to the fund, right? So it's an individual risk. Where as leverage in terms of structure gets harder is if it's wrapped around the entire fund. So if something goes wrong with a single loan, it affects the entire fund. And I think that can be thought about from how we make loans as a lender, as a debt fund. So when we make loans, we typically wrap up the borrowers, all of their assets. So they couldn't have something go wrong on one property and then walk away from that and still have loans with us that are doing fine. No, everything is together. It's a package, right? So they can't walk away from a single loan. They've got to finish that project, even if they're losing money on it, because on their projects they're making money on, they don't want us to take those away. And that's the same thing in how leverage on the fund works, right? You can't just walk away. So we tend to have, as a fund, to think about it and put an example, we have 3 or 4 leverage facilities with different banks. How do those work? And then each of those has a pool of assets that we borrow against, but those pools are segregated, right? So they're segregated. So something happens in one pool, it doesn't affect the entire fund. And that's very important to us, because if a fund, think about it, it's not just does something wrong happen, but for example, during the pandemic, one of the things that happened to the larger funds, and it didn't make the news as much as it should have, was a lot of the leverage providers had what they called repo loans, which were marked to market, right? So our loans are term loans, right? So we ask to borrow the money for 2 years, and typically, as long as there's no default, it's like a home loan. Somebody's not checking on the value every single day to make sure that you can pay it. They just say, hey, okay, are you going to pay it? You need to pay me back in 2 years or 3 years or 5 years or 30 years. Repo is effectively marked to market. So all of a sudden the bank said, hey, your loans that we've lent you on are worth less. I need you to come up with cash in order to pay me back down. Well, where does the cash come from? And that increased their risk. They had to stop lending. They shut off the taps. It's a highly risky structure. Their cost of capital might have been cheaper. So it's just something to pay attention to and ask the question, what is their, if they have leverage, how is that leverage structured? And I don't want to go too detailed in it. I don't think this is the appropriate forum, but, you know, happy to answer questions afterwards if people have very specific questions on this. But let's go into the next one. And then here, just kind of why real estate debt? So, you know, real estate private credit. And again, I would expect real estate private credit returns to be, and again, we're talking about whether you're talking about senior or mezzanine. In this case, I'm really talking about senior. I'm talking about yield on it. So the returns I would expect for funds that are in the sector to be, depending on their varying risk levels, right? So if somebody's heavily concentrated in construction loans and ground up construction loans and short-term smaller loans, I would expect the returns to be higher, closer to 12. I think if they were focused entirely on senior loans, a little bit longer term, they might be sort of in the kind of high single digits. You know, we're typically targeting something in the, you know, on the individual loans that we give, somewhere between a 10 and 12% or a 9 to 12%, I would say. And so then just how does this compare to other sectors? And again, we've looked back, you know, 15 years. So this is, you know, in treasury bonds, you're going, well, I haven't earned 3.6% on treasury bonds. We're taking a longer term view here, not just a short term view of where we've been. And all of this may have rearranged in the past couple of days. I think we've seen some significant drawdowns. And then one of the things to think about is, on these is how, again, with real estate private credit, the loans tend to be relatively short term. They're churning every 12 months, or at least in a number of the stretches. In other ones, maybe it's 5 years. And that's very different than when you're in a bond, which is a corporate bond, or it's a residential bond, RMBS, which may be, you know, 15, 30 years. And so that has more volatility to it. But I think that that's kind of one way to think about it. Anyways, I think you guys get this, and I think you'll probably see it coming through in your own portfolios. So let's go move on from here. And then really just the pros and cons. And I think some of the pros, it's a lower, you know, you are, you know, asset for asset, you're at a lower risk point in the capital stack than you are on the equity. So if the equity falls, if the values fall 20%, and the loan to value is, you know, kind of 75%, the equity has lost almost all of its value, right? So you can be in a position in a senior debt where the equity has lost almost all of its value, and you are still remain in a relatively senior secured position, and that is very comforting. So that's one of the things. One of the pros, again, with it is returns. So relative to other fixed income instruments, where you're talking about either bond funds or public corporate bond funds, rated bond funds, it's a relatively higher return. And we'll talk about, you know, yield and interest rate than your typical fixed income instruments, especially those that are floating on the market. And again, that's some of it could be talking about capital gains, right? So your values going up and down on the bonds versus just kind of your pure yield. And again, so then going on to that correlation. And this is something when we're looking at it, because it's 12 months loans, it's on real estate. Yes, it is correlated to the values of real estate, right? So there is correlation, and that's correlated to the stock market. And let's not say that these things are not correlated, but you're in such a senior secured position that slight movements to the market are not necessarily affecting the value of your portfolio, and especially as these loans are churning, right? So you are getting, it's less correlated to stocks and bonds than your typical portfolio would be. And then you're getting access by, and so then the investing into a fund versus an individual loan. So, you know, I would say one, diversification, you've got access to a pool of loans, right? So instead of making one loan, because you could go out as an individual and you could make a loan to somebody who was doing a fix and flip in an area, you know, it's a lot of work. I would say that. And you have to make sure you get the loan documents right, right? I constantly see this where somebody says, well, I can do this on my own. They go out and do it and they have their lawyer do it and their lawyer isn't specialized in it and they make a mistake and they lose a large portion of the capital, even though they think that they're in a senior secured position, right? It's not like for like. So diversification is important, right? So diversification and access to expertise. I would say that that's not just the diversification, but it's the access to professional expertise that does this day in and day out, you know, for 20 years. And then stability. So real estate debt funds, really what they're set up for in many cases is to provide this consistent returns to investors. So dividend yielding. And, you know, I think there's a few out there that are more capital gains focused, but very few. Most of them are set up to provide a consistent yield. And it's, I speak to investors on a daily basis and I speak to them about real estate investing. I speak to them about other things. I speak to them about their whole portfolio. And one of the things I constantly hear from investors is that search for yield. Where am I getting yield in my portfolio? And I think that's one of the huge, from my standpoint, one of the biggest pros about real estate funds or credit funds in general is the yield component. It's very hard to replace that yield component. So let's go on to some of the risk. So some of the cons, it's not as liquid, right? So, I mean, part of what you're giving up in order to get this yield and these returns is liquidity, right? So it's not like a mortgage bond or, you know, something where it's a pure stock market where you can just pull your money in and out when you want, right? So in order for me to make a loan to somebody for a year, I have to have capital, you know, locked up for at least a year. And so that amount of liquidity matters from fund to fund. Some may have a 5 to 7 year lockup. So it could be a closed-ended fund. You put your money in and 5 to 7 years from now, you know, you get all of your capital back. In between, you may have gotten, you know, your distributions or dividends, but the majority of your capital is locked up for a fixed time. Other ones are locked up for a year or 2 years, and then you can draw down over a certain period of time. Other ones you can draw down a certain period every month. But the fund manager themselves has to have that knowledge that they have some sort of lockup on the capital in order for them to make a loan that is at least 12 months. Second is barriers to entry. It's not that easy to invest in real estate debt funds, right? So typically they're only open to accredited investors or qualified purchasers. So they, and a lot of them aren't targeted, right? It's hard to market and it's hard for a retail investor to go out and find lots of debt funds, right? So typically they're larger and it's, you know, to be quite honest, it's easier to raise capital from a single institution than it is from lots of smaller investors. So historically they haven't been open to, you know, smaller investors or accredited investors. Now that's starting to change, but I think that is certainly one of the things that is in the industry. It's an industry issue, and I think we're starting to address it, but that's one of the things that's gonna happen over time. Second is potential for loss. There is a potential for loss, and I don't think anybody should feel that this thing is 100% secure and that there's no potential for loss. You know, it's the investor goes, I'd like you to guarantee that my money is safe. And anybody who says your money is guaranteed safe, 100% you're getting it back, you know, you should not invest in that fund right away. I mean, I think there has to be an acknowledgement that there is the potential for loss. I think it's lower. And I think if you have to think about it from the equity perspective, right? So the like for like on that single asset, it's more likely you will lose your money on the equity side than you are on the debt side. That does not mean that there is not a potential loss on the principal investment side. Now, I think that depending on the fund, right? In a mezzanine fund, your risk for loss is much higher than on a senior debt fund. Commensurately, your return should be much higher. And then your senior debt fund is probably much more secure. And then how much leverage they use and those things and what type of assets they invest in are also parts of that. But that's something that has to be acknowledged. But again, contrary to what? So are we talking about putting your money in the stock market versus putting your money in a debt fund, right? So if you're really worried about the market, you know, don't be worried about your funds in the real estate credit fund, really be worried about your funds in the equity markets. Risk, you know, a fund can use leverage to enhance returns for investors, but that also adds some risk. And I think there's a balance there, right? So it's, you know, if you have a senior secured position that's very safe, I think it's also good to add a little slight little bits of leverage to that, one for liquidity for the fund, but two for liquidity for just in order operating capital, but two, just it enhances returns. And then second, credit funds sometimes lend to borrowers that can access bank financing. And I think we need to see how that works in terms of accessing that bank financing, what means they might not be able to refinance. It might be a riskier credit profile. That is not always the case, but sometimes it is. Scalability. So one of the things to think about is, and what we spend a lot of time doing, and one of the reasons we focus on a single market is, what I tell people is first I had to build the factory. It's hard to scale quickly. So somebody, they can have as much money as they like. If they say, I want to go to Boston, I want to make loans in Boston. I apologize for the light here. It is hard. You can't just drop $100 million in the Boston market and say, or any market and say, I'm going to make loans tomorrow. You need to find the borrowers. This is not like putting money into the stock market, right? So the fund you're investing in has to be able to allocate that capital. They have to have the access to borrowers, the access to deal flow. They have to be able to create the loans. Not only do they have to originate them, they also have the team in place to underwrite those, document it, close it. And then they have to have the team. And we always say sometimes it's very easy to make the loan. What we need to focus on is getting the money back at the end, right? So that's something to think about in terms of scalability is funds can't drop just $100 billion into the market or $1 billion tomorrow. It really takes time to create those loans. Valuation reporting, these are not mark to market, right? There's not a mark to market for the individual loans, right? That's why they're a little bit illiquid in nature. I will say that is changing. So loans that we make today at 9%, I take those and I can package them up and I can sell them to a credit fund, a hedge fund, and I sell them for 6 because I've done the hard work in originating, closing, and underwriting those loans and packaging them up. Now they buy them in bulk off of me for, you know, $10 million at a time for a 6% rate, and the investors get that 3% difference. Then that fund packages those up into securitization and sells them as institutional investors at $100 million a time for, you know, 3.5% or 4%. So there is some valuation reporting and standardization in the industry, but on an individual loan basis, it's harder to mark to market and figure out what the value and reporting on these are. So let's slip to the next slide. And again, this is our contact information here. IR@rdadvisors.com. Feel free to reach out to us. We are in New York and we're in Boston, and either location, we're delighted to meet with people in person and chat about this. As I hope you can see, I'm passionate about this and I can chat about this for all day, but otherwise I'll open it up to questions and we'll go offline now.
Thank you, Sean. Before we go to Q&A, let's just cover what's coming up next in the NTrust webinar series. Coming up next is on April the 20th. Please register today for ESG Investing Trends. If you want to learn something new, something we haven't covered, please let us know in the survey before you leave. If you would like any more information on self-directed IRAs, you can always visit our website, thentrustgroup.com, and visit our Learning Center. And please remember to follow us on social media for any updates. Happy to go take some questions and answers now. There is a question box in the chat. If you'd like to type in a question, we can get to them. We'll also leave our contact information up on the screen for you. If anybody has any questions, feel free to reach us directly. All right, first question. What happens if you run out of qualified funds to provide for the minimum required distribution and your investment is illiquid? That is for us. You do have options. You can take an in-kind distribution, or you can plan ahead knowing that you have the required distribution coming up. It's always good to speak to your tax professional about your very specific situation, as everybody does have different requirements when it comes to required minimum distributions. Next one's for Sean. Sean, is there a minimum amount of investment required?
And again, for our fund, you know, say it's $50,000. I don't know. Again, that's speaking specifically for our fund. As an industry, I think that's probably on the low side. I think most funds would require somewhere between $250,000 and $1 million, but we've done something where we're kind of opening up to, you know, smaller investors.
Thank you, Sean. Any other questions, feel free to type them into the box. We'll get to as many as we can.
John, I was thinking in the meantime, is there any questions that you typically get that are, you know, FAQ, so to speak?
A lot. Well, when we do our general, so this is more of a general presentation on debt funds. I think there's probably less, you know, frequently asked questions. I think people are digesting the general topics and kind of thinking about it from, okay, this is interesting. I'm looking at investing in funds. I'm just getting started. Now I'm going to take this back, digest it, and then I'm going to go look at some specific funds. And then people, as they're looking at specific funds, have all sorts of specific questions. So the questions I get frequently asked, I don't have tons that are frequently asked on kind of our general presentations. Those are more, you know, specific. I mean, I think people really and this is just general, is really how secure is this, right? And it's very hard for me to answer that question as we're doing a general presentation, right? We can answer it somewhat on ours, right? So what happens in there? Have there been defaults? What are industry defaults? What are historical returns? But those are more specific to the fund than they are specific to the industry, right? Because it's so broad when you're talking about mezzanine or senior and different structures.
Great, thank you.
But what I expect is, I think people, you know, again, they have our contact information. And I think what will happen is people review the materials on our fund and other funds, and then we'll come back and feel free to email me or set up another call to ask very specific questions about our fund as they're comparing it to other funds, right? I think that's the way to learn about it, is go out and look at a whole bunch of these things, review it with kind of the toolkits that, you know, hopefully I provide today as part of the educational seminar, for them to go through and understand, here's one group's, you know, fund versus another, and now they can piece apart. That's what today's session was about, is giving them the tools to be able to ask those specific questions, right? To be able to ask somebody, okay, what is your average loan size? What is the average duration of your loan? Okay, what is your average LTV? Are you senior secured or are you mezzanine? Right? What are the questions that they should be asking? So that's when I expect the specific questions.
Great, thank you.
Thanks, Sean. We do have a few more coming in. Sean, this is for you. Is the fund affected if the housing market crashes?
Of course. All right. And I think the way to think about this is the fund affected more or less than the alternatives if the housing market crashes, right? And so if we look at it, you know, the housing market does not crash in a vacuum, right? What is causing the housing market to crash? Is it the economy? So how is the stock market moving at that time, right? So I'm not meant to say I'm unaffected by a housing market crash. What I'm trying to position myself is saying, if the housing market crashes, and you have money in stocks, you have money in liquid bonds, and you have money in other funds, how is my fund affected relative to those? And so where we've positioned ourselves is, you know, think about it is, well, if we're at, you know, how far do values have to fall? So let's say we're at an average 70% LTV. If values fall by 10%, are we affected? Probably not, right? So in a few cases, we may have some defaults and foreclosures, but even in those, you know, we're, and again, talking on averages is probably not the case, but what it means is there one asset or two assets across the 100 assets in a fund that is affected? Probably, right? Would we take a loss on those? Would it be significant, right? So if our average interest rate is 10% and we lost, you know, 10% on 10% of our loans, well, that's a 1% loss. So that means that my returns would go from a 10% to a 9%, right? You know, and again, I'm doing kind of quick math here, but that's the power of diversification, and that's the power of being in a senior debt position is, you know, a borrower can lose 100% of their capital and the lender could still not take a loss. And so I think it's that relative basis. What are you taking? Because the money is coming from somewhere, right? So the money is coming from one position into another, and which position is safer in the capital stack. And that's what the debt funds are. But yes, certainly we're affected by the real estate markets, as is everybody else.
The next one's gonna be a two-part question. It's two separate questions, but the same attendees, so we can do them together, both for you. How do you currently find your borrowers, and how many do you have? And is the fund a senior debt fund?
Yes, so we are a senior debt fund. So 95% or probably 99% of our positions in our fund at this point are senior debt positions. Sometimes we have, and this is a think about it, sometimes we have a senior debt position and somebody has a second piece of collateral where we're a second lender on it. So we'll have, not only will we have the senior loan on one property, but what we'll do is what I call a collateral grab, and we'll say, well, wait a second, you also have this collateral over here. I want a piece of that. So I'm going to be in second position over here, but really my primary position is the first position. And I'm just doing that as something that I have extra collateral to make it even more secure than it otherwise would be. So I just want to be clear on how we answer that. And so I guess the second part of the question, so one, are we senior secured? Two, how many borrowers? So right now, and it changes day by day, so we're closing loans every single day. We're about 70 individual loans in our fund. So that doesn't necessarily mean 70 borrowers. I would probably assume, and I guess, you know, I'm guessing today that it's probably 50 different borrowers. So a few of the borrowers are repeat borrowers and they continue it. Some borrowers may have, and a borrower can be two different things. Sometimes you think of a borrower as a person, but we only lend to properties that are in LLC. So it could be an individual has a different LLC per property, right? So they personally guarantee it, but the borrowing entity, which is the company, right, the LLC, is the borrower, right? So everyone. And then how do we source all these? Well, we have a distribution list just for Boston today of developers, investors. That's about 3,000 people that goes out every month in a, you know, monthly newsletter. We host events. We're very hands-on. So, you know, I tease my team, you know, today I've got my suit jacket on, but the majority of the days is, you know, we're not the, you know, Patagonia vest wearing finance guys, right? You know, we're wearing our Carhartts. We're on the job sites. We're meeting with people. We do events on construction sites. We meet with our borrowers area. We host education, just like we're hosting educational seminars for people looking to invest in debt funds. We host educational seminars for borrowers that are looking to work with debt funds, right? And we've been around. So, you know, I'm from the Boston area. I have my own investments here. We advertise widely. So we're on, you know, believe it or not, you know, a lot of borrowers are on Instagram, right? You go to sell your development, you post it on Instagram, they're posting it there for potential buyers and other brokers to look there, but they're also posting it there and they see, hey, here's things that, you know, RD Advisors has lent against in Boston. Hey, I know that development. That's a cool development. Let me contact those guys and see if they'll lend on my development. So there's a lot of brand awareness. And that's one of the things that we're in a single market, a sharpshooter, that we really try to own that market and stay in there so that we're, you know, I think most people in the market know who we are and have a pretty good idea about what it's like to work with us.
Thank you. What is the average holding period of a real estate debt fund?
So the holding period, I don't know. My average loan today is about 12 months. So, you know, we originate a loan and it's a 12-month loan. I'm not buying it and then selling it. And that, you know, I would think of that as like a hold period for the investment. We are doing, you know, what I would call bridge loans in many cases. And they could be anywhere from, you know, people borrow the money for 1 month and then refinance with a bank. The bank just didn't have time to close it. Or it could be something where we closed a loan that's 12 months and then they need a little bit more time and they pay a 1% extension fee and the interest rate increases. So, you know, that may be up to 18 months, but on average, it's about a year is our average loan in our fund. The duration of our fund, it's an open-ended fund. So it's effectively, it's you know, not infinite, but But investors are locked up for 1 year in the fund, which kind of matches our loan period, right? So if we, as things roll off, we're able to give investors liquidity, and that liquidity come over 4 quarters. So I'm answering two questions there because I'm not sure which one they'd asked.
Thank you. This one's a long one, covers a lot of topics. What is your long-term projection on how long this real estate boom will continue? This attendee heard yesterday that there's a 4 million home inventory shortage. Any other facts that support this current boom? And what geographical areas are the hottest right now in your portfolio?
Yeah, so one, you know, first kind of working backwards on it, we're focused on Boston, right? We find Boston is a market that we know very well. We're entrenched in the market. We were lending in several other markets, but what we found is it's much better to be focused and concentrated on a single market, both for meeting the borrowers, but also understanding it, right? So I think people, the level of understanding we have of the market isn't, here's what drywall costs are on this market, but here's the top five drywall guys, right? Here's the general contractors we know. We know the names, we know the people. We're really entrenched in the Boston market, right? We own investments here as well as individuals as part of it, right? We understand how things work. We know the city, we know people in the city. So it's a very different thing than us being invested in a whole bunch of different markets. So that's kind of like where we are in that market. The kind of how long the market lasts, you know, I'm kind of like the Economist magazine. I've predicted a recession, you know, predicted 9 of the last 2 recessions, right? So, you know, we built this fund with the idea, you know, back in 2017, my partner and I said, hey, this bull run can't last forever. I don't know if it's another 1 year or another 5 years, but at some point this is going to end. And I need to have a portion of our portfolio, and we need to set up something so that when it does end, we've got something that's consistently producing returns and is lower risk, right? So when that market collapses, right? And I think that's the thing that I've found having gone through these cycles is everybody says, and there's a portion that says, yeah, this thing is gonna last forever. And everyone thinks that they're smarter than the people in the last cycle because this time they can predict it. And I think that's what it is these things tend not to be predictable. And if you wait to the last minute, right? So if somebody says, well, the market's still going well, I'm gonna keep my money in the market and I'm gonna keep the high risk till it's not. It's too late because that thing changes liquidity, leaves the market instantaneously. It happens overnight. And it's shocks that people aren't aware. So I think if you're thinking about the market may have a downturn at some point in time, take your view on the market, take it now, because if you say, I'm gonna wait till the last minute, it's too late. And I had this, you know, we had this conversation with a friend who's a real estate, you know, individual investor. And, you know, he was thinking about investing in debt funds. And he says, you know, I wish I'd done it 2 weeks ago because now the money I was gonna take out of the market, well, now the market is worth less. So I don't have as much money and I don't have as much liquidity. You know, I should have done this a few months ago, but I thought everything was fine, right? And so I think that's the problem is I think everybody's waiting till they need to get defensive. And I think you should constantly have a portion of your portfolio as defensive because you don't know when that's going to happen. And I think we think of it the same way as we have some signs, but we're always playing defensive because we don't know. Long-winded, but I guess that's, you know, hopefully it gives you a bit of my insights and views on it.
Thank you, Sean. The next one, how do you invest in your funds? So I can cover the first half and then we can pass it over to Sean. To use your IRA, you need to create an Entrust self-directed IRA, either traditional or Roth, and you can fund that IRA via a transfer from a current IRA to brokerage firm or a rollover from an old 401k. Once your Entrust account or your self-directed IRA is funded, you'd reach out to Sean and Sean will provide, the company will provide you with the proper documentation that would list the IRA as the investor. Sean, you want to elaborate if I missed anything on that?
I think that, and we have an investor relations team, so that they would handle that. I think there's a few documentations. We'll need, you know, proof of accredited investor, but that's the basic gist of it.
And if you need further answers on that question, the contact information is up on the screen. Feel free to reach out to either of us directly. Next question, anything that talks about taxes or interest rates or ROI, please, you know, contact Sean directly as that has to be answered offline. Do investors receive a 1099 or a K-1 from RD Advisors Investments?
K-1.
Do you offer a single diversified senior debt investor pool or does an individual investor subject to lending? Specific borrowers?
No, it is investment in a fund, which then makes investments to individual, you know, makes loans to individual borrowers. So it's effectively a diversified pool or a strategy.
And when do those K-1s go out?
Specific date? I'd have to get back to you on it.
You could email Sean directly and he'll be happy to follow up on that question. And this one, maybe a little more elaboration may be needed. You can email us to send a real estate development request. Who should I direct it to? Please reach out to us via email, or if you can quickly update your question, we'll be happy to answer it. We have a couple of minutes left.
Dan, I tend to focus on the investment and the management of the fund and the fund's investment, and that includes the asset management side of it. From the, you know, investor relations and the tax side of it, that is the side that I'm very, you know, fortunate and lucky to have other people to handle it. So those questions, you know, we'll get back to you on. And some of them we just can't answer, right? Like tax questions are really questions more for the individual. We can talk about what we do on our side, but how it affects their taxes or how they are taxed, that's beyond the scope of what we can answer.
Great. Well, that wraps up our Q&A. Thank you very much for joining us, Sean. It was very informative. Thank you to all the attendees for joining. The webinar will be available in our Learning Center, and will also be emailed out to everybody.
All right. Thank you, everybody. I hope this was informative for you. So,
have a great day, everybody. Bye-bye.